Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to this episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers. I'm Katie Butner from the Center on Violent CS Women and Children, and for today's Coffee Chat, we're talking with Dr. Leela Wood from the University of Texas Medical Branch. Enjoy our coffee shop environment and our discussion of Leela's work with the Violence Against Women Research Consortium.
Thank you so much for being here. At the start of all these conversations, I just ask that you give a quick intro to who you are and like who's in the room. So if you can tell me just your name and kind of your area of work in the field of violence prevention and just addressing intimate partner violence.
Sure. So my name is Leela Wood, and I am an associate professor and the director of evaluation at the Center for Violence Prevention at the University of Texas Medical Branch. Center for Violence Prevention is located in Galveston, Texas. Our center is statewide. I am part of a group of people that live in Austin, Texas, our capital city here in Texas. And we have folks in Galveston, Houston, Dallas, Austin. So the center's mission is really have a state, national, and international look at a spectrum of violence prevention strategies that focus on intimate partner violence and sexual assault, but also focus on a broad range of structural types of violence and systemic racism, homophobia. So really looking at violence from a sociological perspective and an interdisciplinary perspective. And definitely what I bring to that team is a focus on intimate partner violence and sexual assault. So that's mostly what I would talk about. But I think it's important to mention that we've got folks at the center who really focus on other types of violence, like migration violence, like violence from racism and all kinds of different types of violence and harm.
Yeah. Can you talk a bit about how you got to be where you are? Because I know a common thing is, you know, you're sitting in a medical school, a medical branch, and that is not the standard model for where violence prevention sits. I think we could certainly talk about why it might be important that we address that from that perspective, but it is still not the standard of how violence prevention looks.
So I grew up in Bloomington, Indiana, which is a college town that is, if you could think about like kind of the classic Midwest college towns, Madison, Ann Arbor, East Lansing, Bloomington's definitely the smallest, but it is a liberal university college town in the middle of a pretty conservative state. And I was raised by a single parent. I'm the fourth of five kids. And all of this is actually really important because my mother, who passed away 2 years ago, worked in the domestic violence movement for nearly 30 years. So for anybody listening that had a single parent, you know that sometimes you have to go to work with them. So I started going to work with my mom. My mom's first job in the movement was she ran a childcare, one of the first kind of all day full care trauma-informed childcares in the state that was located in the domestic violence program in Bloomington. And she had a background in early childhood education. So I went to work with her a lot. And that gave me a really window into intimate partner violence and sexual assault. And it also gave me a really unique window into working with people who have had kind of a lot of adverse experiences and how people are not defined by the worst things that happened to them. You know, I think one of the great things about going to work with my mom from an early age is I saw how dynamic all these families were in terms of their traditions, the foods they like, the way that they communicate with each other. So people were a lot more than their traumas to me. And that really became a foundation of how I approached working with survivors later. So one of the things that was really cool for me about having that experience was being exposed to a lot of different survivors and kind of being able to grow up in that environment, and also being able to grow up in a feminist organization. So when I was a teen, teenager, I became really interested in sexuality education, violence prevention, and I started volunteering formally at the shelter. And then I had my first paid position in the movement. The day I turned 18, they were able to hire me, and I became a youth prevention educator. So that ability to kind of have the shelter and the agency such an important part of my life really installed in me that for the rest of my career, regardless of being a social worker or a researcher, my main focus is really on ending intimate partner violence and sexual assault.
Yeah. So I think that's such an important point to share or expand on, how that, and partly I can ask this because I know a bit about your history, but having that initial experience, how has that then led to the informed research that you are doing and the type of research that you are most rooted in?
Yeah. Well, one thing that was nice is, you know, I started as a prevention educator, and then I had just about every job in the book at this particular agency and other agencies. So I was able to work from a variety of positions. And my mother transitioned from working with children to working with adults. And I was really inspired by her and her work. She was unconventional in her approach to her work in that she used a very relational model that was kind of more how advocacy was back in the day. While my mom had 3 master's degrees, her approach to connecting with humans was not in a traditional social service model. And I think as a single parent, she was really able to connect with people on a different level. So my mom had that, you know, kind of provide so much inspiration to me. But my older sister has worked in the movement now for, God, I don't want to date her, but 23 years. And she
started when she was 5. It's fine.
She started when she was 5. She's older than me. She also started when she was 18, and she's done a lot of different, you know, so, and my oldest brother is a child psychologist who works primarily with children exposed to violence.
Wow.
And my middle brother, who's my big brother, leads a harm reduction agency where they spearhead a lot of work around supporting sex workers. And then my kid brother is a musician, so that's good.
Right.
So one thing that is really kind of critical for my story is that I had these jobs, but my family brought so much inspiration to me, not only them as individuals, but their networks. When listening to my mom's colleagues, listening to my brother's colleagues, listening to my sister, who is the policy director for the Texas Council on Family Violence, and her colleagues, and just hearing what their needs were. Their needs as a profession, and then their needs later for research. And that really instilled in me that when you're thinking about a research project, you want to be in touch with not just what the executive director says. That's very important. They usually have a very good 360 view on what needs to happen. But working with direct service providers and executive directors and survivors to understand what the data needs are, how the data is going to be used and treated. Is it going to be used to advocate for certain policy positions? Is it going to be used to ask for money? Often that's the case. Is it going to be used to tell a story about lived experiences of survivors? How does the data need to be used? What format should it be in that makes it accessible? So all of that learning from the field, and I keep learning, right? This is like an ongoing thing. That really has instilled in me that the best work I can possibly do is the work that the field asks me to do. And so I think that comes from my own personal practice experiences, but it's really more just the ongoing connections in that community for me and what I'm hearing about what their needs are. And as a researcher, it's a lot more satisfying to design for me, it's a lot more satisfying to design a program evaluation that gives an agency some vital information rather than a study that has data that nobody's really asked for. Right. So it's satisfying to me as a researcher for sure.
So this is a lot of just like a curiosity, but like if you were to give percents or even breakdowns, like how often are you still seeing, I guess, that happen? And I know that might be like a little bit of a naive question, but I guess like being surrounded by folks who are having that conversation more and more, I guess there's this perception that maybe we're doing that much better. And I guess in my mind, it's like, how much are we still seeing studies that are happening or things that are being done that really aren't rooted in that?
Let me think of how to answer that. It is still happening.
Sure.
It doesn't happen a lot in my field of social work, as much so. There is tremendous pressure to get external funding for research.
Right.
And some of the external funding sources honor community-led research, evaluation, quasi-experimental methods. So in the domestic violence sexual assault world, some experimental designs are really unethical to conduct. So there, you know, we as a field have some unique struggles fitting in the box of some funding. So I think that means that some research still is getting funded that is not as community requested or oriented and isn't as high impact in terms of its applicability to the field right now. I think part of that is a unique issue with violence research. And I think part of that is because there are a variety of disciplinary perspectives that really range in their connection with people on the ground. So it depends on who's doing the research. It depends on what kind of funding they need to get. And it also depends on how people kind of create a hierarchy of research. So traditionally, program evaluation is not considered one of the most rigorous or desirable types of research to conduct. And that means that especially really career scholars that are trying to kind of establish their careers don't get as much support to do those kinds of high impact evaluation methods because they are not as impressive on promotion and tenure. So there's a kind of a lot entangled in that.
Yeah.
I do think there is ever-growing awareness that connecting with the field is really important. But I have one other thing to say about that. So it's not so much that I hear about connecting with the field, but I hear a lot about exploitation from researchers. That is still happening. That's a concern to me. And that's that idea of I'm coming in, I'm collecting this data, I'm getting this information. It's the problem of we got the grant, I'm getting this data, I'm getting your time. And then I'm taking the data and I'm publishing a lot of papers, but I'm not actually getting the data back out to the community. I think that's one of the problems that we are addressing as a field too.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for doing what you can to give the most appropriate response to that somewhat tough question. And I think like, right, it's a little bit of almost what I would have expected you to say around like, it's a lot more structural issue that we still, and not that we ever will not, or not that it needs to be different. I'm not sure that I at least have a professional perspective on it quite yet, but that, like you're saying, we work and operate in a structure that is reliant on external funding. And that external funding is generally guided by a lot of reporting expectations of ethical guidelines, and not that they shouldn't be there, but they're really specific and really rooted in a lot of ways that I would argue our Western society operates, which is very like institutionally protective. So wanting to make sure that we're keeping our structures, you know, safe and also like free from, you know, getting in trouble for things, right? Like we're really like, I guess we're really cautionary around like making sure that we're doing something in a really particular prescribed way to avoid any kind of like external problems or like anything like that. And again, we want to be taking care of participants, but I think at the end of the day, it's kind of even a little bit what you're talking about with your mom's style of relational engagement and like relational activity. Research still struggles with figuring out how do we bring the human into data without like losing or discrediting people's experience as information. Because at the end of the day, like our base of data is like numbers. We get numbers. We get when you can run things. So like human beings are not that in reality. On a day-to-day basis, they're operating with so much other stuff, and like figuring out how to capture that and also do it in a way that fits into the expectations of external funding can be really, really challenging.
Yeah. And I think one thing as a mixed methods researcher who definitely does more qualitative work, you would not want me to run your stats for you. I think one thing that when we're thinking about like multiple truths in terms of having a more postmodern perspective or having a more critical perspective and looking at structural inequities, high quality, rigorous violence research, especially domestic violence research, may look pretty different methodologically in terms of, you know, if you compare it to other public health research. Like the kinds of designs and engagement that you might use in smoking research is going to look probably a little bit different than high quality violence research. And one of the fields I look to for inspiration is what's happening in the movement around opioids and harm reduction. There, we've got a similar parallel where we're not going to refuse someone life-saving antidotes for overdose. That's not going to be part of our experimental design. And the very same thing is true for intimate partner violence when we're looking at the kinds of interventions I like to look at, which are really more on the secondary, tertiary prevention scale. These are things like emergency shelter housing, childcare, cash assistance. So what's rigorous and what's high quality there is going to be different than what is rigorous and high quality even in universal prevention research strategies. So I think that's really an important thing to keep in mind when we're talking about external funders, because when you take that paradigm of the random controlled trial with no qualitative research that is very successfully funded and very rigorous and important in other fields, it doesn't translate as well to violence research, especially IPV research. And that makes some of that research a lot harder to fund. And that is a struggle for us as a field. We don't fit into a lot of the boxes very nicely. And especially if you're someone like me who is really more focused on tertiary prevention or intervention research, you're not going to fit well into the box of primary prevention research. So there is some finesse that is happening in the field around that. What that means to me is that it is even more imperative to work with our community partners and to work with survivors to understand how those interventions are working, who they're working for. And it means that in communication, what I'm really trying to do is to get people excited about secondary and tertiary prevention. Because we all agree primary prevention is the gold standard. I want to stop all of this violence before it even happens.
Yeah.
But it's hard to deny, looking at my data sets, looking at other people's data sets in the field that I greatly admire, that some of these IPV interventions are incredibly successful in reducing and preventing violence from happening again. That is a really critical story to tell. And there are ways in which programs are offered that make them more impactful and ways that make them less impactful. And that's really important to tell. So I think part of it is thinking about how we can get that story out in a different way, knowing that there are structural disadvantages in the current funding landscape to getting that work funded.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Can you speak a little bit more on secondary and tertiary, like findings and interventions and sort of what you see emerging from that, like greater understanding, I guess, in those ways particularly?
Yeah, absolutely. So my work really focuses on looking at advocacy. Advocacy is the supportive service model for violence work, especially. So I'm talking specifically about intimate partner violence, teen dating violence, sexual assault. So advocacy sometimes is conflated with case management or counseling. And it's neither of those things, and it's closely linked to both. So advocacy is typically a non-clinical modality of supportive services that is looking at increasing resources, addressing safety, supporting mental health needs, and enhancing stability to survivors of violence and their children. That sounds a lot like case management, right? Lisa Goodman and Chris Sullivan have a great paper where they kind of outline why it's not case management. And what's a little bit different about advocacy is that it is both micro and macro. So social workers will understand this concept. So it's that micro one-on-one interaction of getting folks resources, helping them get housing, providing emotional support, doing safety planning. But advocates also advocate on the meso and macro level with community SARTs, with school districts, with other folks, for individual survivors, but also for survivors as a whole. So it's a unique model to the anti-violence field. Some advocates have counseling backgrounds, especially on college campuses. That's a very typical model we see. And the vast majority of them use supportive strategies, trauma-informed care, strengths-based perspective, all these things we learn in social work, right? But they may not be counselors, properly trained counselors in that way, but they're providing mental health aid. So I've spent my career looking at advocacy in all of its different iterations and forms. So some of that has been on college campuses. A lot of times I'm looking at advocacy in shelters and transitional housing. We're looking right now at advocacy on chat and text platforms. So when I'm thinking about tertiary and secondary prevention strategies, advocacy is one of the ones that I think about the most. It's actually one of just the things work-related that I think about the most. And it's really understanding when you're working with people that have experienced adversity or been exposed to violence or experienced violence, witnessed violence. There's a lot of feelings about what phrase we use to talk about youth where there's domestic violence in the home. So I won't even go into that today, but when we're thinking about youth and adults who have that experience of domestic violence, sexual assault, we're really thinking about how can we prevent them from having those experiences again, and how can we increase stability? That's important for a couple of different reasons. Repeated violence episodes are really detrimental to people's health and economic stability. That's kind of critical area one. The other thing is, while generational cycles are not a be-all, end-all situation, and certainly there are people breaking those cycles every day, we know that a big predictor of having kind of future victimization perpetration is having that happening in your house when you're a young person. And that, unfortunately, if you experience violence as a younger person, it really increases your odds exponentially of experiencing it again. So just knowing the health consequences, knowing the economic consequences, knowing the risk, it, to me, one of the most meaningful spots for me to be in as a scholar and just as a human on the planet is working with folks that have had some hard things happen to them and getting kind of services right for that group of people. And part of that has been a luxury to be able to focus on because we have so many amazing scholars and activists and practitioners we're focusing on primary prevention. I grew up in primary prevention, but I actually feel like there's some great work happening there. So I've been delighted to kind of transition to focusing on more secondary, tertiary prevention with families that have already been exposed to violence. So it feels like a good spot for me to be in.
Okay. Thank you. That was a really helpful explanation and overview, because I think where my hope would be that some folks who are interested in listening to this have no idea about necessarily the field, and so would maybe be learning a bit about the things that you're focused on, the research that you're passionate about, and would be curious to then learn more from here. Of course, I imagine there will also be people listening who are just generally huge research fans of you. So
I think one thing I think about with advocacy is most common practice used by partner violence survivors in IPV specific agencies.
Yeah.
There's huge variations in how it's provided. And if you're an evaluation geek like I am, you know that fidelity is really important to intervention outcomes. There's also, just as a field in general, we honor and promote a survivor-centered model, which means that there's a lot of adaptation that happens in our model every day.
Mm-hmm.
We're also a field who are serving largely women, non-binary folks, people in the LGBTQ rainbow, and a lot of people of color. In my state of Texas, the majority of folks coming into services are people of color. So that means you're working with people from many different marginalized positions, but you're also working with people who have several intersecting cultural identities that really need to be an important part of the service model. So when we're thinking about advocacy, it merits so much more attention than we give it, because there's so much variation happening. There's so many core fidelity issues, and it's the most frequent service we provide.
Yeah.
And it is probably one of the most understudied services we provide. I have been really lucky to learn from some of the titans in the field and to modify and extend their research. But there aren't enough of us looking at these particular modalities that are so common. That's something that I'm trying to engage people in terms of thinking about how we provide these services and how we assess these services in a way that I think lends to sustainability and kind of increased quality across the IPV movement. And quality means being more survivor-centered. Quality means being more socially justice-oriented. And I think that one thing that we want to consider as researchers is it is really exciting to go after the novel idea or the new practice or the new treatment, but there is a gem sitting right in front of us, and it's the most common services happening every day. We actually don't have a great evidence base for it. And that to me has just seemed very problematic. So that's, you know, why I focus there.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's a great segue into talking about sort of what you're doing now, specifically kind of what you're excited about moving forward in your work.
So I think you know this about me, Katie. I'm the kind of person who is excited about everything. I'm easily excitable.
One of my favorite things about you.
Yeah. I am really excited about, let me answer the first part, which is, I have spent the last several years with various amazing collaborators looking at advocacy models in a variety of settings, primarily housing programs for IPV survivors, college campuses, and chat and text. You would think, well, it's kind of all over the place, but it's really not. You can kind of set your watch to the logic model for all three of those. That work has been incredibly gratifying And we're at the point now where we have a sense of kind of how advocacy is being adapted in a variety of settings. And we're preparing to do what for our setting is the appropriate kind of next level rigorous look at advocacy outcomes. I am really excited about continuing that work. Other thing that I'm excited about, and this has been a really great advantage to being at Center for Violence Prevention, where our director, Jeff Temple, is a primary prevention expert in teen dating violence. We have been doing a lot of work as a center working with adolescents, especially adolescents and emerging adults really impacted by COVID. I mean, we've seen in the news kind of about mental health and COVID, especially for adolescents. So I'm excited about the work that we're doing, connecting some of the learnings from the intimate partner violence field around advocacy counseling with teens and adolescents who may have experienced teen dating violence or peer violence. And we're starting to kind of connect prevention programming with some of these secondary and tertiary models like chat and text advocacy, which is, to me, somebody who's really interested in reaching survivors and interrupting or bending cycles. That's very exciting work. So the third thing I'll mention that I'm really excited about, and this is probably the thing. So I would never say I'm most excited about something, but I maybe am most excited about this. For the last several years, I have been focused really, really heavily focused on economic remedies for intimate partner violence and sexual assault. And most of that focus has been on housing. And that has extended really now, post-COVID especially, to be about housing and childcare. We did a lot of work in Harris County, Texas, and across the state of Texas, looking at kind of the needs of survivors during COVID and housing, childcare, or, you know, the two big ones. And one thing we see in our data is that cash assistance works in terms of bringing stability and reducing violence for survivors. So we have an Office on Violence Against Women funded evaluation of transitional housing that's led by my frequent research partner, Dr. Bethany Backus, and I'm the co-PI of that. I'm very excited about that work. And I'm continuing that housing work that I've already been doing in Texas with a couple of other sites, really looking at impact of these economic remedies like childcare and housing when you add our intimate partner violence advocacy model to it. So I'm really interested in continuing to look at not only advocacy models and economic remedies for IPV, but what happens when we combine those two. So that has been, that has consumed me for the last couple of years. So I'm excited to be launching a couple of different projects where we're really digging into that and where we can expand our knowledge base so that we can kind of hopefully inform policy and funding, but also identify some of those core factors of success in our service model and in those economic programs.
Yeah. So similarly, I think that's a really great segue into talking about sort of the gaps in the field and like the next steps in that way. What are you seeing as being maybe those core areas that you want to see addressed or pay better attention to, right? Of course, there's, like you're saying, about being similarly excited about almost everything. There is a, you know, a lifetime of things that we can keep learning and addressing and that we will keep seeing, you know, needing to be better understood. But if I would ask you the kind of tough questions of knowing where your work is now and the things that you're seeing in the field, what do you see as those big gaps that you'd like to see continued funding be addressing or continued, you know, priority, I guess, be given in the area of violence prevention?
So I think I'm going to focus on two things with that. The first one I want to talk about is, I said one of the things I was really excited about is our work with adolescents and emerging adults. So our center director, Dr. Temple's work with adolescents, and then I do quite a bit of work with emerging adults, and have gotten a lot of mentorship from my mentor, Dr. McMahon. So I think one thing that I'm excited about, but I think is because it's such a huge gap, is really looking at what work we can do, what interventions we can develop, what supportive services can do, how we can better support schools and residential treatment centers and all kinds of things, college campuses, in terms of working with young people who have experienced violence to bend or interrupt or break cycles of violence and risk for re-victims. So there's this robust evidence on teen dating violence prevention. There is a growing field of adult intervention research. I think one of the crucial gaps is what we can do with young people who have experienced a teen dating violence relationship, who have been sexually assaulted, who have witnessed violence in their homes growing up, and we know that they're at increased risk. There are targeted prevention programs for that group in particular, but what there seems to be a pretty substantial gap in what we're doing from an intervention perspective and from a risk reduction perspective with youth and with emerging adults who have experienced violence. So I see that as a pretty substantial gap. And one of the reasons why I'm really dedicated to continuing that work is we just completed a 3-year study of campus-based advocacy services for survivors of violence. And when that report is released, one of the things that is in there is just basically how effective those programs can be in reducing future incidents of violence. I know that when we reduce future incidents of violence, we increase somebody's safety and stability, but we also increase their positive health outcomes across their lifespan, and we reduce generational transmission. So it seems like a very critical thing to work on. So that to me is a big gap that I am excited to work on myself, and I'm excited to partner with other folks who are doing a lot of that youth-focused work and are similarly engaged in that scholarship. Because to me, it seems like a glaring hole. We've got this incredible risk factor here. And we have really strong prevention interventions that definitely could be stronger, but, you know, and we have this kind of system of care for adults. But what are we doing for this group that we know is like very vulnerable? Who have already experienced violence. That to me seems like such a glaring hole. I'm really excited to continue that work.
Yeah.
That's one gap.
Okay.
The other gap is, and this all relates to what I'm excited about. So I get excited about the gaps. I actually get excited about anything that my colleagues at Texas Council on Family Violence or Texas Association Against Sexual Assault or NNEDV or my colleagues at my local domestic violence program, anything that they see as something they need information on is what becomes an important gap to me. So the other gap that I'm really focused on as well is looking at the long-term impact of economic remedies to address intimate partner violence. And that's primarily housing and childcare, but also cash assistance. We know that those remedies are effective from a collection of program evaluations and some emerging more statewide evidence, but we have not had the support or the infrastructure, the funding to look at those things on large scale and especially look at trauma-informed childcare, intimate partner violence-focused rapid rehousing, things that are really focused on the needs of our population. It's a huge gap in our understanding of how we provide stability in terms of services and, you know, kind of fidelity in terms of service models, but also in kind of one of our most effective, what it looks like to me is one of our most effective bets at preventing future incidents of domestic violence are things like housing and childcare. And it seems like a critical gap in our understanding from a data perspective in terms of scaling up some of our smaller scale studies. So that is my other gap that I'm very much focused on. The third one I'm going to mention is actually something I'm not sure. It's like I want folks listening to hear this who have a different skill set than me. Across our different data sets, what I see pretty consistently are high persistent rates of depression among intimate partner violence survivors. Some of our counseling interventions are very effective at addressing depression. Some are not. And so a gap for me in the field is addressing depression and the long-term impacts of depression among intimate partner violence survivors. I think there's a lot of things happening there. Access to ongoing mental health care, the depression and trauma of poverty is a big one. Lack of access to psychiatric care. You know, there's the kind of connection between depression and employment. There's a lot going on there, but I think as a field, we need to reckon with that gap in knowledge of how we address depression.
It's a very big point. And like you're saying, for anyone who might be listening and has that experience and background, give you an email, send you an email and let you know. Cause yeah, I mean, there's a conversation in there around like sustainability of intervention work, you know, like, because if a person's mental well-being and their levels of mental health, right, are not being addressed as well. It's a bit of that conversation around like the whole person, that doing an intervention in this one way around this thing that ultimately is effective, but we have high rates of depression, like you're saying, or high rates of something else, you know, how does that then end up impacting so that we're not actually seeing the strongest efficacy here either? Mm-hmm. Right. It's that we can't just handle one gap. We have to try to look at the other because they feed into each other and ultimately lead to what we would consider a successful next step versus like something that's not gonna really create sustainable change in that person's life.
Yes. Absolutely. And knowing that our interventions are, from the data that I see and that I've been part of collecting, are generally fairly effective at reducing future incidents of violence and increasing economic stability, housing stability, but seeing that we're not as impactful at addressing things like depression.
Yeah. Ultimately, the goal would be for a human to be able to live you know, their best existence. And without addressing that, that doesn't make that true or possible, right?
Yes. And I think this is where being a qualitative researcher really helps, because I'd be concerned about these quantitative depression rates for sure. But when we've had a couple of studies over the last several years where we've longitudinally looked at housing, and you can see in those interviews kind of depression being a persistent issue for folks, even when some of their economic and housing stability or safety factors change. And hearing that kind of lived story component of it and really having it humanized as part of that post-violence recovery experience, it does just kind of highlight some gaps in what we're doing in terms of addressing the persistence of those symptoms.
Right.
And I'm not a clinician. So, you know, I just make friends with clinicians. So I can get some insight into how we would deal with that.
None of us can be everything. So
yeah.
you know, and which, you know, reiterates that point of being community connected and listening to the voice of the folks who are doing the direct work, if that's where your work is aiming to impact. You know, it's got to be informed in that way. You know, otherwise it's going to fall flat and short. So,
yeah, I definitely identify as a generalist and an intimate partner around sexual assault generalist researcher.
Yeah.
And I think part of that identification as a generalist means that I am looking to collaborate with practitioners and with policymakers, advocates, activists, but also with other researchers who either are generalists and in slightly different ways, or have that clinical expertise or have that population expertise. You know, so I think a really good practice for people who are researchers is really getting comfy with what you don't know.
Yeah.
And having that be okay. But what keeps me really interested in research, and I've been like this since I was a kid, you know, my family's saying was, if you want to find out something about someone, send Leela to interview them. So I think for me, the whole idea about research is that humans, and dogs too, I know that now since I've gotten one, that humans are really interesting. And I am interested in how we support survivors and how we help survivors, but also just in people's stories. And it's not just survivors that I'm interested in. It's also the staff, the movement staffing all of this work.
Yeah.
You know? And so entering with a spirit of not knowing and curiosity that's coupled with really questioning my assumptions and my belief as a social worker, as a white woman, as somebody who grew up with different experiences around privilege and also grew up poor, you know, in a single parent household. Like there's a space between being an expert, not knowing, and really having a lot of transparency about who I am and what I bring to the table. And I would say for new researchers, that's actually quite a bit of work, but it's something to keep in mind that kind of like reflection and check with other people. Like, hey, I will frequently say to colleagues, I am seeing this situation or this data this way. How do you see it? Or can you tell me how you see this data? Because I am thinking maybe my lived experience or my identity position is making the data seem a certain way. And I think that's why collaboration is so important, especially in qualitative research.
Yeah.
So I would just say for people embarking on this research or embarking on this work, that collaborative piece, especially when you're thinking about what you bring to the table in terms of who you are, is really critical as a layer of transparency and as a layer of quality.
That's such like helpful advice, and similarly gives me the opportunity to talk a bit about the model of doing this Violence Against Women Research Consortium. And like, while we are, because at the end of the day, the funding for me to do this work and be in this position comes from that project, which is, you know, wrapping itself up for the most part. And you have been very much a part of that model from the start. And so I'm curious to hear your perspective on why that might be, why you see that as, if you do, I guess, a good way to try to build some of that collaboration, especially across, you know, across the country, but also I think across experience. Like I think in my perspective, a huge success of that work is really the model of folks participating and having an option for research that have so many different methodological experiences, as well as lived experiences, as well as, you know, timelines in their academic career, and as well as, you know, even possibly the ability to work with practitioners as well. So I wonder if you could speak a bit to what that has been like, being a part of the consortium.
I think, you know, thinking about the consortium in terms of a structure for research and for The consortium to me is really a structure for practice-driven research and research that's highly responsive to the field. So my learning from that experience, a couple of really critical things. First of all, I entered the consortium as one of the early career people. So it was an incredible opportunity for me to get a lot of mentorship, especially from the two consortium leads, so Dr. Postmas and Dr. McMahon. That was really incredible for me to have that opportunity. And what I appreciated is they made a really calculated effort to get people lots of different career phases. There's practitioners, there's policymakers, there's early career, mid-career, later career. So a lot of times when people do that, it's to check a box. It's to say, okay, we've got these people in all these different positions, or, you know, our community is very diverse. We have 3 men, 2 women, 4 people of color, 1 gay person, you know, but with the consortium, the difference to me, you could feel it right away, was everybody had value where they were at. So I wasn't brought in as this early career person to check a box. There was a very specific needed purpose. It was like, everybody had an important role to fill that was very valued. That was a huge difference from, we've invited you to be here so that we look like we're mentoring. It was like, you have an important role to play. We expect you. So there was responsibility. There was accountability. We expect you to play that role. And that was a difference right off the bat. To other things like that I've been was that there was intentionality behind everybody's roles, and everybody's roles had the same weight of value. So, you know, from Judy, from Dr. Postmas, she gave the same weight of value to everybody, and that set a tone. And so that was part of the consortium, was the value base. And I use value in kind of a tentative way, the ethical base, in terms of it was a collective of people who were all valued in a certain way. And then the expectation for that collective of people was to bring more people. So it's like a potluck of researchers where you're supposed to bring a guest and everybody's supposed to bring a dish. And you don't have a complete meal until everybody shows up.
Yeah.
But there is this little bit of coordination of like, we can't all bring a tray of brownies.
Right.
So I think for me, the accountability, the value of practitioner knowledge, the value of mixed methods of qualitative research, so just like the intentionality behind all of that.
Sure.
Was really incredible. And then just connecting across all those different, so you had mentioned kind of methodological variation in terms of what people brought to the table, or role variations, career phase. Another thing that was really cool about that is people's content knowledge base. So I was able to work with somebody who had really intensive knowledge around human trafficking and cyber. Those are not my primary areas. I was also able to work with, you know, kind of bring my lens on campus stuff to work with another consortium member who has really specific knowledge of Latinx, Latina populations. So there was an ability to kind of connect with people on those things, not only in core projects, but also in discussions of kind of the gaps of the field. So my hope is that some of the work that the consortium did on identifying gaps is picked up and extended. And I also think it needs to be revisited because COVID then happened. So I think probably for me, the experience of the consortium was a really high value experience as an early career person, but it was also a high value experience in what happens when we really take an opportunity to learn from other people, which academics are hard. It's hard for them. That, you know, there's a lot of competition in academia. There's a lot of being the loudest person in the room, having the most brilliant idea, getting promotion and tenure. What the consortium crew from NIJ, Tina Crossland, Judy Postmas, Sarah McMahon, what the leaders of that did was they set up a space where people could not know and be vulnerable, and where people could be authentic sharing about what they didn't know. And I think that that process-oriented model is really important to keep in mind when we're thinking about how we move the field forward now. How can we replicate that? Especially when we have so many pressing issues from COVID and from our, you know, kind of second pandemic of racial injustice. Like, now there's so much more to do. That all was there before, but it's critical that we keep the gas on right now and keep moving forward. And so I think the process learning from the consortium can help us with that.
Yeah. I think that's an incredible call to action. So my wrap up for everybody is always, if you had like an unrestricted pot of money, if you had nothing built to do, what would you do with it? Research wise, of course.
A national study of housing vouchers and cash assistance and childcare outcomes for IPV survivors. And then I think, you know, I would also, with this kind of unrestricted fund, really want to look into not only recruiting IPV survivors, but IPV survivors with adolescent children, and understand some of the critical intervention points working with that population. But in terms of what I would need this dream money for, because it's harder to fund, I would definitely want to do a national study looking at the impact of cash assistance, childcare vouchers, and housing vouchers.
Well, here's to that. And here's to that money happening. And maybe, right, if we put it out in the laws of the universe, if we say it, it'll happen.
I've got the team to do it. So
you're already ready. You just need, so whoever's listening.
I literally have written the grant, and I'm just going to keep shoving it around.
All right, great, perfect. Well, we're one step closer to that happening, because who knows?
Thank you. Good question.
I envision that someone's going to listen to this at some point and just call you up and be like, I'm ready, I've got the money for you. And then we're going to make that happen. So
thank you.
I appreciate what you have done for me. Leela, it's always wonderful to talk to you. I'm so happy to be able to hear you, but also I get the privilege of being able to see you right now. No one else will, but I can see you. But thank you. And thank you, as always, for the work that you do. And just for being such a warm and welcoming person and a dedicated, you know, advocate in the field. So thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me. This was awesome.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to my chat with the always incredible Dr. Leela Wood. If you'd like to hear more coffee chats, you can always find them at vawconsortium.rutgers.edu. And as always, email us your thoughts, your ideas, and even just to say hi, we love to hear from you. So until next time, stay curious, ask questions, and we'll see you back here for our next coffee chat with researchers.